This is Virginia Insight. I'm Tom Graham. How'd you like to speak with a future U.S. senator? One of two men will be elected to that post from Virginia in a few weeks. Both are slated to be with us for just a few minutes each in the hour ahead. Former governor and former senator George Allen is the Republican in the race. We expect to have him on the line 1/2 hour from now. Former Governor Tim Kaine is the Democrat. We expect to have him in just a few minutes right after the news. If you want to speak with Mr. Kaine, this would be a good time to get to the phone and dial 888-WMRA-TALK. If you want to speak with Mr. Allen, be sure to call before the bottom of the hour, 888-967-2825. Also with us, political analysts Bob Gibson and Bob Roberts. You're welcome to share your thoughts with them anytime in the hour ahead, right after we get through the news. I'm Tom Graham, and this is Virginia Insight. Politics are our focus this hour, especially how a myriad of hot-button political issues are now playing out across the Old Dominion. We've made arrangements to spend a few minutes each with the two major party candidates for U.S. Senate in Virginia. Republican George Allen is scheduled to join us at the bottom of the hour. Democrat Tim Kaine should be with us in just a very few moments. As always, our call-in number is 888-967-2825. Easy to remember as 888-WMRA-TALK. And as most always, whenever we dive deep into things political, we've got the two Bobs with us to help. Political scientist Bob Roberts from James Madison University, plus former political reporter, now head of the Sorensen Institute, Bob Gibson. Gentlemen, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you.
And it looks like we do indeed now have former Virginia governor, current Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate, Tim Kaine with us. Governor Kaine, thanks so much for making time for us.
Yeah, Tom, it's great to be with you and the two Bobs. Looking forward to visiting.
Well, I want to play, Governor, a very brief audio clip for you and then get your response. I think you will recognize it, even though it's now some 2 years old. A lot of us have heard it repeated many times, so here's one more.
Our top political priority over the next 2 years should be to deny President Obama a second term.
That, of course, was the man in charge of the Republican caucus in the U.S. Senate, Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, speaking right after the 2010 elections about what he saw as his party's top political priority. So my question, Governor Kaine, does that commitment from Senator McConnell made back in 2010 have any relevance, in your view, in the current election cycle?
Well, you know, Tom, it definitely has relevance in the election cycle, but more especially in the governing cycle. I think Americans want to see a Congress that can act and a leader that describes their job responsibility not as creating jobs, growing America's status in the world, getting back to number one in the talent race, but instead our main job is to deny the president a second term. That was a very candid and sad admission. My father-in-law, who was the first Republican governor of Virginia in modern times, and I chatted about it when it happened. It was like, wow, this is the party of Lincoln. This is a party that really stood for something. But once it was defined that the main goal was to deny the president a second term, I think that says an awful lot about why Congress has been so incredibly ineffective in the last 2 years. We got to have people who are going to go in and work together for the good of the country, and not just spend their time focused on the political result.
I know you want to talk some about the economy and fiscal issues. We also have several questions posted on our Facebook page from listeners. We won't be able to get to all of them, but let me get to at least a couple.
Sure.
First one, would you support H.R. 3126, Stop Child Abuse in Residential Programs for Teens, Act of 2011?
This is a bill that I've heard described. I haven't read all of the facets of it, but as I've heard it described and my staff and I've chatted about it, it sounds like a very good bill. When I was governor, my wife worked very hard on reforming Virginia's foster care system to make sure that children who, you know, are either in group homes or foster care homes are treated right, and we need to make sure that they are safe so that they can grow up to be strong and productive adults. And this is a bill that has that same purpose, and I'm definitely supportive of that purpose.
This from Amy, who says, we've been hearing much lately in Virginia about the potentially devastating effects of defense-related sequestration cuts to Virginia. However, these federal deficit reduction efforts could also result in huge cuts to programs that serve needy children. Which of these programs will you fight to make sure are preserved or even strengthened?
Tom, we have to make a decision. Congress has to make a decision right away. And the cuts to defense and the cuts to the non-defense items that are important, they do not have to be deep if we do what I've been advocating for a year. If you let the Bush tax cuts expire at the top end, and I have put a compromise proposal on the table, if you let the tax cuts expire over $500,000, then instead of $1 trillion worth of sequestration cuts over 10 years, you cut it in half. You get $500 billion of revenue. You end up having to make $500 billion worth of cuts. And then I have some other strategies for ways to reduce that number even further. But there's no way you're going to be able to close this gap without really harming defense, Medicare, and education if you don't let the Bush tax cuts expire. That's a sharp difference of opinion between my opponent and me. He wants to make the tax cuts permanent. That would bust the deficit, and then the cuts you would have to make to close the deficit at that point I think would be devastating to Virginia's economy.
Amy's question about protecting programs for children, is that an important issue for you?
It is very important. We were real happy when I was governor. We were named the best state in which a child to be raised to have a successful life. We did dramatic reforms to reduce infant mortality. My wife and I worked together on reforming the foster care system, expanding early childhood education. Programs that serve children, and especially vulnerable children, are programs that we should focus on, and the sequestration-style cuts are going to be too deep.
Bob Gibson speaking to us from Charlottesville. You've got a question for Governor Kane.
Yes, Governor. Tons of money is flowing into federal elections this year, much of it anonymously. Transparency and full reporting are Virginia's accepted traditions and the law for campaign contributions larger than $100. But in federal elections, you can give $1 million anonymously through super PACs and other entities. How would you propose to fix that problem at the federal level?
Bob, I would go in and I would sign right away on as a co-sponsor of legislation. What I call it is a no secret money rule. No one can give money to a candidate, to a state party, to a national party, or to an advocacy organization that wants to influence an election cycle without that contribution being made public. As you know, I did a debate with George Allen in December of 2011, and I challenged him, let's have a race with no super PAC involvement whatsoever. He turned me down on that offer, but I went back in February and said, hey, let's do something different. If you want super PACs to participate in these elections, let's at least agree that they have to disclose their donor so that Virginians are aware who's funding them. Even though he had praised campaign transparency in the past, he turned me down on that one as well. I will go into the Senate very focused on reforming the laws so that donors to campaigns have to disclose their identity so that citizens can know who's behind campaigns.
Former Virginia Governor Tim Kaine, now Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate. Sir, if you are elected, what will you be doing in the U.S. Senate? What will you be pushing for to help the economy?
Three things primarily that we really need to do, I think, to grow the economy, Tom. First, we've got to level the playing field for small businesses. They're the job creators, not ExxonMobil. And what you do is you make the tax code fairer for small businesses. You help small businesses with export assistance, access to capital, and the ability to participate meaningfully in government procurement. That's the first thing you do. Second thing you do is you invest in infrastructure. I believe that we can, the more we build, the stronger our economy will be. So roads, bridges, rail, broadband rollout. If you invest in infrastructure, as President Eisenhower showed, you hire people right away, and then you enjoy the benefits of the infrastructure improvements for decades. And finally, I really believe that our long-term economic strength is directly tied to our talent. Win the talent race, win the economic race. And so that means education from pre-K to post-grad, workforce development, innovation, research, and development. That's why I worked so hard to do economic development deals when I was governor, like bringing SRI to Shenandoah Valley and working on other important projects. Those were driven largely by having a talent system in terms of our schools that would attract great employers, and that's what we need to do as a nation.
To stand a chance of succeeding, would you need to get rid of the filibuster rule in the Senate? Would you favor getting rid of the filibuster 60-vote rule?
Tom, I'd favor dramatic reform of the filibuster rule to make it what it was originally intended to be. I'd keep the filibuster because it has a venerable tradition at 60 votes, but we should make anyone who filibusters have to stand on the floor and filibuster so that the American public and the Senate colleagues can see whether the individual has a good point in trying to block passage of legislation or whether they're just trying to be an obstructionist. When we moved away from the speaking standing filibuster to a paper filibuster, we deprived the American public of the ability to look at that senator and determine whether they got a good point or they're just trying to gum up the works. So we make filibuster an actual speaking filibuster as it was. And second, I would change the rule to deny anyone the ability to use the filibuster except on a final vote for passage. The minority party, in this instance the Republicans in the last 2 years, have used filibuster over 80 times, and often it's being used on procedural votes that just slow work down. The American public is entitled to get business done, and that means we've got to confine use of the filibuster.
Former Democratic Governor of Virginia Tim Kaine, now U.S. candidate for Senate or candidate for U.S. Senate. Governor, I promised your staff we would not go more than 8 minutes because I know you've got a next event to get to, and I've already gone 30 seconds past my limit. Thanks so much.
Well, Tom, thanks. And to Bob Roberts and Bob Gibson, I look forward to being on again. I appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you.
Bob Roberts, he talked a little bit about sequestration and the impact on defense and other issues. I know that's something you've paid a lot of attention to. Your thoughts?
Right now, both the Allen campaign and the Romney campaign are pounding Obama and Kaine for theoretically backing the defense cuts. Somehow they were a partisan decision by the Obama administration to support defense cuts. They were not. Even Bob Goodlatte from the 6th District signed on to that budget deal, and most of the delegation in Virginia signed on to that budget deal. So to frame this as a partisan defense cuts is just not accurate. And it's sad that it's come down to this, that the Republicans who agreed to this now are trying to turn it into a campaign issue. It is just not very accurate.
Bob Gibson, would it be your view that the Republicans are succeeding in making it look like those defense cuts are something that the president is doing all on his own?
I don't know if they're succeeding. I mean, it's people do not watch what's going on in Washington generally and the public with the level of interest that they're able to assign specific blame to one party or the other. They just sort of throw their hands up and say it's a mess and both parties are to blame. And in this case, both parties are to blame for putting sequestration on the table as the mechanism for getting to something better, only they haven't decided to get to anything better.
Mitt Romney, right. Bob Roberts, is out with a new ad where he talks about defense spending.
Right.
Can you remind us what...
What he's saying is that Virginia, the exact quote from the ad, if sequestration goes into effect, Virginia will lose 130,000 jobs. That's a quote. And this Obama is to blame for this because these are his cuts. And once again, they're not his cuts. The majority of the Republican delegation in Virginia agreed to this provision. Even though it was a terrible idea, they agreed to it.
Paul Krugman, the liberal economist who's also a Nobel Prize winner and New York Times columnist, was out with a column yesterday that reminded me of some things I've heard from you before, Dr. Bob Roberts. He was talking about Mitt Romney's approach on defense spending, saying not only that this is from Mr. Romney, must we not cut defense, but we should increase the spending, right, in part because it will create jobs. And Mr. Krugman saying, how can you go to the extreme that Republicans have gone in saying government has no role in creating jobs and that what we need to do is to cut government and then say when it comes to defense spending, that kind of government spending is okay.
Right. Even more strange with Romney's position on defense, which is more disturbing, is that we've gone through two wars, and hopefully these two wars will be over. At any other time in American history, when the wars are over, we cut back on defense spending. And now Romney is saying spend more on defense, which seems to say he perceives we're in this Cold War and that we need to spend more on defense. Who are we in a Cold War with? And he has said so, Russia. And so that's more disturbing, why he wants to spend more money on defense.
Bob Gibson, before we hit the break, just quickly, how satisfied were you with Governor Kaine's response to your question about campaign transparency?
Well, I think he intends to make reporting something that happens in federal elections, but I don't know if he has his party and the rest of the Congress in a position to do that. So It's a very big problem in Washington that's only increasing.
We've got other problems and issues to talk about. We'll be back in 1 minute. To you who are listening, we'd like to take you into the halls of mythical television news for just a few moments, then ask if what you are about to hear is something that you do see as relevant in the upcoming election. Now, perhaps you're familiar with a new HBO series called The Newsroom. It's based on the premise of a fictional cable TV news operation, and the people and stories that have occupied that fictional place over the past 2 years. Whether it was the Gulf oil spill, the debt ceiling crisis, or any other topic, viewers are treated to outtakes from real newscasts combined with the imaginary. In the season finale that aired just recently, much of the focus was given to a topic that some think is an important issue in the upcoming election. The clip we're about to hear features the voice of fictional news anchor Will McAvoy in a made-up newscast from the summer of 2011. You'll notice some change in the quality of the audio as the camera shots move from the anchor desk to the control room, as the news anchor talks about an African-American woman named Dorothy Cooper.
Dorothy Cooper is a 96-year-old resident of Chattanooga, Tennessee, and has been voting for the last 75 years. This year, she's been told she can't. A new law in Tennessee requires residents to show a government-issued photo ID in order to vote. Dorothy Cooper doesn't have a driver's license because Dorothy Cooper doesn't have a car. Dorothy Cooper doesn't have a passport. A vacation abroad was never in her future. Tennessee isn't alone. At this moment, 33 states have proposed or already adopted the same voter ID laws that have disqualified Dorothy Cooper from the one fundamental thing that we all do as Americans. It's estimated that 11%, or roughly 20 million people, don't have government-issued voter IDs and will be disenfranchised this November. Why? To crack down on the terrible problem of voter fraud.
Rule 5.
Governor Rick Perry of Texas, who is about to enter the presidential primary race, is serious about cracking down on the problem.
Making sure that there's not fraud, making sure that, someone's not manipulating that process makes all the sense in the world to me.
To me, too, because voter fraud is such a huge problem that during a five-year period under the Bush administration, when 196 million votes were cast, the number of cases of voter fraud reached 86. Not 86,000, 86. Here's what that number looks like as a percentage of votes cast. 0.04%. This would be called a solution without a problem, but it's not. It's just a solution to a different problem. Republicans have a hard time getting certain people to vote for them, so life would be a lot easier if certain people just weren't allowed to vote at all. I'm ashamed to say that 32 of the 33 voter ID laws were proposed by Republican legislators and passed by Republican-controlled state houses and signed into law by Republican governors. I am not, however, ashamed to say that I am a Republican. And that brings us to tonight's second story.
From the fictional HBO television series, The Newsroom. Bob Roberts, was that at all a realistic portrayal of what's been happening with voter ID laws?
We're seeing voter ID laws enacted in those Republican states with the express or implied purpose of disenfranchising, I would argue, Democratic voters. Whether they're that extreme in terms of all requiring photo ID, such as driver's licenses, they are not. There are differences between state to state. Almost all the states have enacted them, have included provisions whereby voters can go to the motor vehicles department and get an ID other than a license. However, those are difficult to get to the motor vehicles department.
Which is why a federal court recently knocked down the Texas law saying that there are many people who are poor who would have to travel many long distances, don't have access to a car or transportation, and access necessarily to the documents that they would have to present to get that.
They would have to get their birth certificate, which is not always easily available in terms of, so it would be an impediment, and the judge found this was intentionally designed to disenfranchise voters. A similar judge, another judge in South Carolina, did the same thing with respect to South Carolina. So these laws are clearly intended to depress the vote of poor individuals who tend to vote Democratic, and the voter fraud, nature of voter fraud is not what most Americans think. Voter fraud does not apply generally to people casting other people's votes. what it normally applies to when someone has misregistered. For example, a felon in Virginia who can't vote and who has not had their rights restored registers to vote. That has happened. And therefore, that occurs much more frequently.
But this type of law wouldn't catch that.
That would not catch it at all. And so the purpose here is put up barriers to make it more difficult for people to vote, and with the goal of leveling, making it more difficult for Democratic candidates or liberal candidates to get their voters out.
Bob Gibson, Bob Roberts says that this is clearly an attempt to suppress the vote of certain leaning voters. But isn't it true that a lot of Republicans feel, at least they have said, that this is an important issue to maintain the integrity of voting?
Well, I think fear of voter fraud is much greater than voter fraud. And that has proven to be the case all over. And we don't have a great history of significant voter fraud here in Virginia. And Virginia also didn't go to the extreme that some states did that have had federal judges and the Justice Department file and rule against them.
Virginia's law has been upheld.
Right.
Virginia
in
has
part,
been upheld
though,
by
isn't
the,
it, Bob, because the original legislation as passed by the General Assembly would have required photo ID, but the governor amended that to allow other types of ID.
It was amended so that you don't have to go to great extremes to go to the DMV and track down a birth certificate. There are other sources of identification you can use, and the state has also put up the money to send every registered voter a voter ID card later this month. So those should be arriving in the mail this month to every voter in the state who's registered. And as Bob Roberts pointed out before the show, I think you have 22 days before the election.
Correct.
And we're about 58 days out, 56 days out.
And it's very important for voters to understand that. Okay.
Well, you can finish.
Okay. Even if they don't have ID and they get to the polls, they'll be able to vote a provisional ballot, but they will have to, within a day, provide an identification to the registrar regarding their vote.
Well, we'll get back to this issue and want to let our audience once again know if you have comments or questions about anything you've heard us talk about so far or have a different topic that you'd like to bring up that relates to politics in Virginia. We do have phone lines open for you at 888-WMRA-TALK, 888-967-2825. However, if you would like to talk to the Republican candidate for U.S. Senate, then you got to call right now, 888-967-2825. Because joining us now by phone is former U.S. Senator, former Virginia governor, and now once again, Republican candidate for U.S. Senate, George Allen. Governor Allen, thank you so much for making time for us, sir.
Good to be with y'all.
Can you hear us okay, Governor? We had a little bit of a click there. I don't know. Can you hear us okay, sir?
Yeah, I can hear you now.
Okay. My apologies for whatever technical challenge there was there. I wanted to let you know, sir, that in our conversation with your opponent earlier this hour, we started by playing a very brief audio clip, and I want to play the very same clip for you now as well. It is some 2 years old, but since it's been repeated often, I think you'll recognize it.
Our top political priority over the next 2 years should be to deny President Obama a second term.
And that, of course, was Minority Leader Mitch McConnell, the man in charge of the Republican caucus in the U.S. Senate, speaking right after the 2010 elections about what he saw as the GOP's top political priority. So my question, Governor Allen, is whether that commitment from Senator McConnell made back in 2010, does it have any relevance in your view in the current election cycle?
Not for as far as I'm concerned. I think the primary goal that I'm advocating for and trying to motivate people for are positive, constructive ideas to create more jobs with a strong economy and unleashing our American energy resources. So I always like to talk about ideas and solutions and reforms rather than personalities or partisanship.
So the argument that some are making that you cannot criticize the Democrats for not having succeeded with their policy proposals for creating jobs if, in fact, the Republicans' focus for the past 2 years was to obstruct anything the Democrats proposed, you don't see that as a legitimate argument.
No, it's not a legitimate argument. The Democrats and Congress had both the House and the Senate and the White House, and they passed that stimulus spending, which they promised would create more jobs, and it certainly hasn't in the way that they said it would be. It hasn't done as promised. They passed the health care tax law, which from what I hear from people, and then they passed that on in the Senate by one vote, really on Christmas Eve. And that has been such an impediment for small businesses to hire. I've listened to, for example, the chairman of the board of the Wythe County Community Hospital, and he says that this Obamacare is going to put rural hospitals out of business. You hear from people worrying about their employers no longer providing them health insurance because it's cheaper for them to pay this fine or, excuse me, this tax on it. It is also seniors are very concerned. Yeah, they may have health coverage, health insurance, but they're not going to have access to doctors who will see, Medicare patients. So it's and then for some people, their religious liberties are being violated. So there's so many things wrong with that, and that's besides the rating of over $700 billion from Medicare, so to pay for the rest of Obamacare. So the Democrats have had their opportunities. The Republicans are in a minority. Obviously, in the House now, they're in a majority. What we're seeing, though, is when the House passes something, nothing happens in the Senate. There's no Republicans who are stopping a budget from being proposed in the Senate for now 3.5 years, which to me is very irresponsible. They ought to, if they don't like what the one body passes, pass your own version and then work out the differences in a conference committee. That's the way basic civics works and the way laws ought to be made. So,
Governor Allen, excuse me for interrupting. We do have several questions posted on our Facebook page for you. We're not going to get a chance to get to all of them, but I want to see if I can get to a couple of them briefly. One of them says, would you support H.R. 3126, Stop Child Abuse in Residential Programs for Teens, Act of 2011?
I'd have to look at it. Obviously, I don't want to see child abuse in residential programs for teens. And I'd have to look at the details of the law. It seems to me that if the current laws are insufficient or what the rationale behind the law is, obviously, if the title's anywhere near what the purpose of the bill is, it seems like a reasonable thing that people could be united behind.
Governor, here's another question from someone named Paula who says, I'm interested in hearing the candidates talk about their position on hydrofracking.
On hydrofracking, I think one of the great game changers and benefits that we've seen is the increase of natural gas through hydraulic fracking and the shale gas. And folks have seen that in Louisiana, Texas, obviously the Marcellus shale in Pennsylvania. And North Dakota is booming. It has the lowest unemployment rate in the country. And then people are not moving up to North Dakota because of their nice weather and beautiful beaches, and they're using fracking there. And so I think that can be done. You need to have cased wells to make sure that there's no interaction with the gas or the shale oil with the water table. But where the shale gas is, or the shale, is a much deeper than where well water would be. So I think that it can be done, and it is being done very safely, and I think it's very beneficial for having affordable natural gas as well as oil in some of the places where they have shale oil as opposed to shale gas, or sometimes both. And I think that's great for jobs and great for people in their homes.
Republican candidate for U.S. Senate George Allen is with us. Governor Allen, here in the studio with me is Bob Roberts, political science professor from JMU. Bob, you have a quick question for the governor?
Governor, do you support returning the authority to the states to approve or disapprove oil and gas exploration?
Yeah, I sure do. Just like the innovations that have come forth on shale gas, we know in Virginia that we have oil and gas off our coast. And if I'm hired on to represent the people of Virginia in the U.S. Senate, right after being sworn in as a senator, I'm going to introduce a bill to allow us in Virginia to produce oil and gas off our coast and then use the royalties for roads and transportation. And legislators in the General Assembly in both parties have been in favor of this. The only impediment has been Washington saying no to us. And so I think that states that want to produce off their coast ought to be able to do so. For those that do not want to, they shouldn't be forced to, but Virginia does want to. There's other states to the north of us and California that are opposed to it, and that's their prerogative. But we in Virginia would like to have those jobs and provide that energy and that revenue for Virginia as well as for the nation.
Governor Allen, I know you have only a few more minutes, a few more moments to be with us, but if you would, before you go, talk a little bit more about what your priorities would be if elected to help revive the U.S. economy.
Well, my focus will be jobs, the economy, and energy. Energy is the solution to much of what ails our economy, and right now you have EPA, in effect, assaulting coal and outlawing it, and ultimately what will happen is we'll feel the same pain paying our monthly electric bill as we feel at the gas pump. So if we unleashed our American energy resources from our coast, from the Appalachians to the Rockies, from the Gulf of Mexico, all the way to the North Slope of Alaska, that's that barren North Slope, there'd be hundreds of thousands of good-paying jobs created. We'd be more competitive for investment and jobs. We'd have more affordable electricity, fuel, and food. We'd be less vulnerable to hostile outside forces, and the federal government could get well over $1 trillion of revenues without raising taxes. So it's a good job creator. It's good for revenues for the government, and it's good for national security. The other thing that needs to be done is stop the sequestration deal that is going to be devastating to our military readiness, as well as over 200,000 jobs in Virginia that could be lost because of the latest failure from Washington. So generally speaking, what I'm going to do is be making sure that you work with anyone to make sure we have a strong economy, a strong national defense, and make sure that we reinvigorate the entrepreneurial spirit of our country. And that means you have to have pro-job growth, more simple and competitive tax policies. It means reasonable regulations. It means productive energy, and it also means empowering education. And if we do that, we can send a message to the world that America is open for business again, and that's going to be my priority.
Former governor, former U.S. senator, I'm sorry, Bob, that we actually have run past the time that we promised the governor's staff that we would keep him here on the air. So, Governor, I know that you have another event to get to. Thank you so much for allowing us to spend some time with you on Virginia Insight, sir.
Well, the pleasure being with all y'all, and look forward to seeing you on the trail ahead.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Bob Gibson, I'm so very sorry. But I wanted to ask you what your impression was, what struck you most about what you heard from Governor Allen.
Well, I think he's campaigning on a jobs and energy campaign promise that he's going to get more jobs and more energy exploration in Virginia. And, you know, that's popular in parts of the state. The folks in the coal part of Virginia do feel that the federal government has been unrealistic and unfair in clamping down on coal mining. Other parts of the state probably support the EPA, but the regulations are very unpopular in the western half of the state.
The hydrofracking would be very unpopular out here. There is little support in this part of the state for hydrofracking, the most Republican area of the state. So that's interesting in terms of he's willing to spend that much time supporting hydrofracking, when the indication is that the residents in this part of the state do not want it.
Okay, we have no more scheduled candidate guests. We have no more audio clips. We do have the two Bobs with us to share their perspective on other political issues, but we also now have all of our phone lines open. So if you have a comment on anything you've already heard or a topic you'd like to see explored, call us at 888-WMRA-TALK. Bob Roberts is a professor of politics and a professor of public policy at James Madison University. He's also an attorney, but we promise not to hold that against him. Bob Gibson reported on politics at the Charlottesville Daily Progress for more than 30 years before taking his current post as executive director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership. I'm Tom Graham. This is Virginia Insight. We're looking at the latest in Virginia politics on this edition. And if you want to join the conversation, we've got a phone line open for you at 888-WMRA-TALK. Have either of you gentlemen noticed anything, you know, in terms of like conventions or speeches or anything that have struck you recently?
Clint,
yeah, the empty chair.
The empty chair and other things. I think the conventions have reinforced the idea maybe we don't need them anymore since they didn't produce the balance for either candidate. And
well, there's no middle to bounce. I mean, everybody has made up their mind except for a very narrow band of the electorate that may or may not vote.
Right.
So, the events were more designed to juice up the base in each party than they were to appeal to folks in the middle.
But conventions did mean something at one time. And the reason...
Well, that was a long time ago.
I know.
Basically, they've been speeches for TV for a generation.
I agree. But they are somewhat arcane. In other words, we keep doing them for more historical value than for anything else.
Well, we wouldn't have President Obama if it hadn't been for the last...
That's true.
...time he was a convention keynoter.
Keynoter.
The universe apparently felt that we did not have enough Bobs. Because now we have one calling in from Buffalo Gap. Bob, thank you for joining us. Your question or comment for the other two Bobs, please.
All right. I think all of us are pleased that there has become a tradition of three debates among the presidential contenders. And in Virginia, we're having three debates between the Senate contenders. We have congressional districts here in Virginia in which that tradition hasn't gotten underway. In the sixth district over here, we have Bob Goodlatte going for his 11th term. Who's playing games with Andy Schmuckler and whether he will debate at all, and if he will debate, maybe one debate, and that without on television. I would think that it's the interest of the citizens of this district and of the state as well that there be three debates between the congressional contenders. And it seems to me it shouldn't really be up to the candidate, to the incumbent at all, that there should be an expectation, in this case, of Bob Goodlatte, would debate three times with Andy Schmuckler, presumably in the top three population areas in the district. That would be Roanoke.
Bob, hold on for us, if you would. We got the general sense of your point, but we're having some trouble with your cell phone line. Bob Roberts, how do you feel about if you're running for Congress, you got to commit to debates?
I agree, but there's no way to force anyone to commit to a debate. And if you're running so far ahead and you have so much money, the argument on the other side of the incumbent is, why give my opponent free airtime, and therefore they should debate, but there are no sanctions if they don't.
Is there an argument on the other side? A candidate like Bob Goodlatte, who in this past several election cycles, if I'm recalling correctly, has won with somewhere between 64% to 68% of the vote.
Right.
Just phenomenal landslides. Polling shows him far ahead again.
That's right.
Wouldn't he go ahead and debate on the perhaps the point of view of, look, I'm so far ahead, nobody's going to be able to touch me no matter how the debates go?
You might think so, but you're afraid that the opponent is going to be able to force you to take public positions that you don't want to take. And therefore, you would be inclined to be a little more cautious because you never know what's going to happen and you don't want to give your opponent free airtime. I oppose it, but the fact of the matter is there is no way to force a candidate to participate in a debate, and therefore there's no legislative solution to this.
Bob, I do appreciate your question and taking the time to call us. I will let you know, by the way, that the congressional candidates who are in our service region, the WMRA broadcast region, which of course includes part of Bob Goodlatte's 6th District, we have contacted all of the incumbents and said, we will offer you a half hour of time on Virginia Insight in conjunction with offering the other half hour during the same hour with your major party opponent. We haven't yet heard back from any of the incumbents because we know it's the incumbents who are usually hard to persuade to do this kind of thing. But stay tuned. There's always the possibility that even though it's not a debate, that we might get the two candidates in the 6th District on the air within a few minutes of each other. Thanks so much for your call. 888-967-2825, 888-WMRA Talk. Let's talk about one of the other congressional races in our service area, the 5th Congressional District, which stretches from just above Charlottesville all the way down to Southside.
Fauquier now.
It goes up to Fauquier County, right? Yeah. The new district.
We stretch above Interstate 66 now.
66 now to Danville.
So it's a long, tall, skinny district that goes all the way down as a triangle to this North Carolina line.
Jerry, Bob Gibson, when you say our, of course, that's the district in which you live.
Charlottesville and Albemarle are part of the 5th District, and I've had a little better luck. I've contacted Robert Hurt, the incumbent, and John Douglas, the Democratic challenger, and they have agreed to debate each other in the 5th District. The debate will be 7 to 8 p.m. on October 10th, which I believe is a Wednesday. It will be in Danville, and it will be co-sponsored by the Danville Register and Bee and by NBC 29, which will broadcast the debate live in Charlottesville, and by WSET-TV in Lynchburg, which will broadcast the debate live on October 10th between John Douglas and Robert Hurt.
From those distant enough from Charlottesville, NBC 29 is the television station based in Charlottesville. And Robert Hurt, until 2 years ago, was a state senator. He was able to beat a one-term incumbent, a Democrat by the name of Tom Perriello, in the last election cycle. So he's a freshman, and usually, Bob Roberts, freshmen are the ones who are thought to be a little at risk in getting reelected. Usually after you've been elected twice in Congress, you stay for a long time.
And the 5th District was a fairly close district until they gerrymandered it. And the fact of the matter is, by putting that horse country up in Fauquier County, north of Charlottesville, that's a very conservative area.
Are you saying horse people are Republicans?
I'm just saying it's a very conservative area. And it's gonna make it much more difficult for the Democratic challenger to win that district.
The Democratic challenger is a retired Air Force general. What can you tell us about him, Bob Gibson?
Well, he's a farmer. He was intending to run against Frank Wolf in the 10th Congressional District until he was redistricted into the 5th last year. So all of a sudden he changed plans and, like a good general, formulated a new strategy. And
so General John Douglas lives in the northern part of the district?
He does. He lives in the Fauquier County area that was added to the district just last year. So the district now stretches all the way from Danville to Charlottesville to just north of Interstate 66, up the eastern spine of the Blue Ridge through Madison County and part of Culpeper and up to Fauquier.
Bob Roberts, I cannot ask Bob Gibson this question because he has to look unbiased. Well, and he is, actually.
Right.
But as the future moderator of this debate, so I'm going to ask you, how much of a chance does the Democratic challenger stand in this race?
If Obama takes the congressional district and wins the vote, Douglas has a chance. I mean, that's what it comes down to. He'll be riding on the coattails of Obama. Obama did very well in that district in 2008. Perriello did very well. He didn't lose by that many votes in 2010. So the question is how effective the Democrats are to basically get out their base. It's a difficult undertaking, but it's possible.
So it's not a lock for incumbent Congressman Hurt, but he certainly is the odds-on favorite.
Right now he's the odds-on favorite.
888-967-2825, which translates to 888-WMRA-TALK. If you listening have something about Virginia politics that you'd like to discuss or ask a question about. Ruth in Harrisonburg, thanks for joining us. Your question or comment, please.
Well, I had a couple of questions, and I'm sorry that Governor Allen was not able to be with us longer and that I wasn't able to ask them. But he made reference to the budget issue and the danger that with the sequestration plan that there would be significant cuts to defense, and my question is where the political leadership is to look at the amount of defense expenditure that we make, which is equivalent, I guess, to the next 20 countries, 10 of whom are allies of ours. We are spending so astronomically, and I don't have any sense from any statements that I've heard from Governor Allen that he is aware of that a massive black hole down which we have wasted billions. And so I just would really want to take issue with his characterization. But I think, too, when he talked about energy and offshore oil and gas drilling, that, you know, somebody somewhere has to give political leadership here to the questions about what the capacity is of the Earth to carry all of this carbon that we're creating. And I don't see the political courage there in his remarks. There are some shorter-term benefits that everyone thinks are attractive. Those are not in the long term going to put us in a good position, you know, if we're not developing renewable energy. And maybe he spoke to that somewhere else. But I haven't heard it if he has. So I just see a person with a limited, close-up, politically beneficial, perspective on energy, but not one that we really need for real leadership for the long haul. And to say there's a war on coal.
Ruth, I'm going to stop you there and give up and give our guests a chance to respond.
Yeah. I mean, your analysis is correct, but the Democratic Party, Obama, has taken a much more, let's say, a liberal position on alternative energy, and the Republican Party, Romney and Allen, have taken a much more traditional approach. So you have a clear line, and I'm sure Allen doesn't expect a lot of Democrats to vote for him, or conservationists to vote for him, or alternative energy supporters, and the vice versa for Obama. So there's a clear line between the two parties on that very important issue. Yeah.
This race has been the Senate race in Virginia. A dead heat.
Dead heat.
For more than a year now,
right.
Even before Allen won his primary.
Right.
Why?
Because Virginia is split 50-50 down the middle. And the outcome of this race is dependent upon who turns out their voters. Obama has to have a turnout like he had in 2008, or he will lose. What the Republicans hopes that Virginia has a turnout much more like 2004 or 2000, when the turnouts were much lower. And then probably Obama will lose the state and Allen will win the state. And so it's simply a turnout, the ability to turn out moderate and liberal voters, young voters, minorities that Obama and Kaine are depending upon.
Ruth, thank you so much for your call. Bob Gibson, before we run out of time here, we had very strict time limits with both candidates in order to fit us in their schedule today. We knew that we weren't going to be able to keep them on for more than the allotted time. So there are a number of questions from our listeners that got posted on Facebook that we couldn't get to. But there is one here that I'm wondering if you don't have a sense of what Governor Allen's stand on this issue is. This was from Joni, who said, what should be the role of the federal government in reducing the carbon dioxide emissions that are driving climate change? Do you, Bob Gibson, have a sense of what Governor Allen's stand on that issue is?
Well, George Allen has long been a friend of the energy industry in America, coal, gas, and oil. So I would assume that he and many Republicans would question the assumptions that climate change is something that has to be dealt with right now. I think, politics the way it is done in Virginia and the nation today is a short-term proposition. It's not a long-term proposition. They want results within 2 years, not looking 10 years or more down the road. And that goes for budget as well as climate. And defense spending, for example, is looked at as a jobs bill for Virginia.
Sure.
More than a defense act.
Two other congressional races in our coverage area, Frank Wolf, who represents the 10th District, which stretches from parts of Northern Virginia into the Winchester area and Northern Shenandoah Valley, is a longtime Republican incumbent, opposed this time by a lawyer, a Democrat, Kristen Cabral, I think is how her last name is pronounced. Any sense that Frank Wolf is at risk at maintaining his incumbency?
None. His opponent has raised hardly any money whatsoever.
And I hesitate to mention it since he is the majority leader in the U.S. House of Representatives. But Eric Cantor, the incumbent in the 7th District, even though some of his district has been chopped out of our listening area, there's still a couple of counties that he represents in a portion of the WMRA land. E. Wayne Powell, attorney.
No money also. I mean, the gerrymandering was quite successful this time. By the General Assembly, particularly in House races.
Ray, I'm not sure where you're calling from. Would you tell us, please?
Harrisonburg.
We need a real quick question from you, if we could.
I just want to make a quick point that in reference to carbon issues with petroleum vehicles, the electric vehicles are the preferred method by most energy people with green energy policies, they get their electricity from whatever power plants are powering those vehicles when they're plugged in.
I've got 10 seconds for you to make your point.
If they are coal plants, then you're essentially producing carbon dioxide just the same as if you were driving a gas-powered vehicle.
So your sense is that electric cars are not a big improvement?
I don't think so, no.
And Ray, I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. We are out of time. We're at the end of the show. I thank you for calling in. Hopefully next time we'll get a call from you a little bit earlier. But our guests have been Bob Gibson, Executive Director of the Sorensen Institute for Political Leadership, and Bob Roberts, Professor of Political Science at James Madison University, as well as earlier in the program, Republican candidate for U.S. Senate George Allen and Democratic candidate for U.S. Senate Tim Kaine. Many thanks, gentlemen, for making time for us.
Thank you.
We'd also like to extend best wishes to our friend and colleague Anita Kumar, who for many years reported on Virginia politics for The Washington Post, but has just taken a new job as White House correspondent for the McClatchy newspaper chain. We understand this was moving day for Anita, so she couldn't be with us today, but she's promised to make a return visit soon. Anita, good luck with all those boxes, and we are going to hold you to that promise. Insight's executive producers Matt Bingay, associate producers Terry Ward and Bob Levicky had extra help today from Sarah McConnell and Andrew Windham at the Virginia Foundation for the Humanities. Thanks so much for tuning in for this edition. I'm Tom Graham. Hope we can get together again soon for more Insight.